So what I've prepared here, which I think we could just run in the background, like change the slides every sort of minute if you like or whatever. It's not directly connected to the talk, but I think provides some good visual background. So what I've prepared in this slide presentation are covers of, so I've selected a range of covers of Punto Final, which was the main revolutionary newspaper of the period from basically the mid-60s, about 64 onwards. It was at different stages, a fortnightly, a weekly. I don't think it ever quite went to a daily, maybe every 2 days. It was ostensibly an independent paper. What I've done is translate. So at the top is the translation of the headlines, or at least the main headlines, because in some cases there's multiple headlines. It was ostensibly an independent paper, but effectively was the paper of the revolutionary left, which went beyond any one single organisation. So much of the stuff in Punto Final is declarations of the MIR, but also of the Socialist Party, because the Socialist Party, in particular its left wing, which included its general secretary, actually, were very much developed into the sort of revolutionary space, if you like, through this process from the mid-60s on, actually, and I'll quote a few of their Congress documents and so forth, because they were as critical of an organisation from a revolutionary left point of view as the MIR was. So, yeah, this will give you some idea in the background of what was going on. And this paper, of course, carried, as you'd expect, given what I've described, it carried basically the key debates from the point of view of the revolutionary left. Most typically, they were polemics with the Communist Party. I mean, there's lots of sort of great articles and polemics with the Communist Party here, and said I'll go through that. Look, I've probably done this talk too many times, and, you'd think that, especially given that in the last few decades, even quite mild bourgeois democratic reforms have taken insurrectional waves, you'd think that the lessons of Chile would be well imprinted on the left broadly, not just the revolutionary left, but they're not. That said, I mean, most comrades here would be familiar with the sort of broad sweeping lesson, which is pretty simple at one level. And it's an important lesson from the point of view of propaganda and own education of revolutionary activists. Namely, I mean, you can surmise it in a sentence, namely the peaceful electoral parliamentary road to socialism is not likely to happen. It's a relatively simple lesson. And typically, when I've done this talk before, when I've written about this period and the lessons of it, typically I focus, which most of the revolutionary left tends to do, on the actual period of 70 to 73, which is the period of La Unidad Popular, Popular Unity Government, and the rise, very rapid rise of the revolutionary left in the ranks of, well, principally the MIR and the Socialist Party, but not exclusively. MAPL was very much moving to the left through that process as well. So was the Christian Left. That's an actual particular party, Cristiana, et cetera. So typically we tell the story and draw out the lessons by describing events between 70 and 73. I want to do something a little bit different this time because partly because maybe we've all heard that lesson, simple as it is, many times. But also because I think really the depth of the lessons involved for revolutionaries can really only, the intricacies of that lesson can only really be drawn out if you look at the period before 1970. And that's really the key, and that's what I wanted to do here today. In essence, if there's a sort of a thesis to this talk, basically, I want to try to draw out in the context of Chile how strategy and tactics is fundamentally about understanding how class agency plays into historical determinants and in the context of a specific relationship of class forces. And most importantly, in the context of an inevitably under-matured revolutionary subject. That is to say, if you look at any revolution, the Russian included, especially if you look at the Russian between February and October, the revolutionary subject, the leadership, is necessarily, and I think inevitably, always going to be under-matured. You don't arrive at a revolutionary movement ready-made. The Bolsheviks didn't arrive at a revolutionary movement ready-made. And if certain specific circumstances hadn't developed before February, but especially between February and October, and if certain specific tactical decisions hadn't been made, then we may not have had the Russian Revolution. So that's what I want to try to draw out, that sort of inevitable under-maturity of the revolutionary subject and leadership through a bit of a different exploration of Chile. I won't take too long because I think it's more interesting if we have a, sort of a conversation around if people have got questions. But basically that's, if you like, the thesis. So the context first, the sort of, if you like, the to give you an idea of the historical determinants. Well, the big context was the colonial revolutions post-war. That's the big context. I mean, you had, unlike the world we're living in right now, you had revolutions happening everywhere. I mean, in countries that, you know, whose names we rarely say. So, you know, the various Portuguese colonies in Africa, Algeria. I mean, everywhere, basically, you had a colonial revolution happening. So that's the big context, not to mention, of course, the Cold War itself. Continentally, that took a very particular and radical shape because of the Cuban Revolution. So, you know, you had Vietnam was obviously the, you know, the background to all of this, but, of course, that was imprinted by the Cuban Revolution also, which had particular and heavy influence on the Latin American left, you know, in the development of revolutionary movements in Latin America. So you'll see, for example, I think we might have even gone past it, but the OLAS conference, the first conference of the Organization of Latin American Solidarity, which was called by Cuba in Cuba, held in Cuba, you know, played a very key role because it basically created a schism between the established communist parties and the new left. You know, whatever that shape that new left was taking in Chile, that new left essentially became more or less ended up being entirely grouped in the MIR and to some extent MAPU and sections of the Socialist Party. And it took different shapes, sometimes the same name, actually. The MIR was a common name of the new left in Venezuela, where else, I think, by the way, there was quite a few MIRs moving the revolutionary left. But basically that OLAS conference created a schism between the old Stalinist left and this new radical left, which by and large wasn't, for example, like in some other places, especially, of course, Asia, wasn't influenced too much by Maoism, with some small exceptions. It was very much the Guevaraism of the Cuban Revolution. So you'll see, and that had all sorts of ideological impact. You'll see some covers here, again, different times I'll come up, but of whole statements, including, for example, by Altamirano, the General Secretary of the Socialist Party, a very key figure in this moment, arguing against the Soviet model. You know, in fact, his exact words were the Soviet model would not work for the Chilean Revolution. So all these debates were happening and very much imprinted on by the Cuban Revolution. Now, in the context of Chile itself, again, in terms of that, so that's sort of the broad historical determinants, broadly speaking. In terms of the relationship of class forces in Chile in particular, in 1964 you had the election of the Frei government, which was a sort of, probably in retrospect we'd say, sort of centrist Christian democratic government. Centrist because of what happened to the Christian democrats later, which is they went both ways, far right and left. So I suppose the Frei government in a sense was a sort of centrist representation of the Christian democratic government. Basically, they took government, or they formed government in 64 in a context where even continentally, and certainly in Chile, the developmental model of capitalism was just at a standstill. It's going nowhere. You know, the Alliance for Progress, as much as it tried to sort of, Kennedy's Alliance for Progress, pump money and so forth into that developmental model and pump some of its prestige into it and so forth, was really going nowhere, that developmental model. So that was the context in which that Frei government governed between 64 and 69, a model that was just full of crisis. So there was constant and growing mobilizations, workers mobilizations, increasingly growing organized, you know, working class, and in particular, slightly new phenomenon for Chile, not new, but like became very exaggerated phenomenon, which was the massive unionization of rural workers. So that literally doubled or tripled in that period. That partly, of course, had some inspiration from the Cuban model, I suppose, in some regards in terms of what the left was doing, you know, out in rural areas. But regardless, that was an important factor, the radicalization of the campesino movement. So that's both rural workers and peasants, mostly really rural workers, because Chile was never highly peasant-based type economy, you know, like some other Latin American countries, so mostly rural workers. And you also had an increase, not as massive, not like twice or threefold, but quite a significant increase in unionisation in the urban centres as well. And most importantly, the political character of the union movement started to change, or at least be challenged, because the younger workers were not accepting, basically not accepting the Stalinist domination and the Christian Democratic, but essentially still itself Stalinist domination of the unions, the good and all the individual unions. So that was the big change in the organised work, labour movement, the unions, not so much a growth, massive growth in numbers of unionised workers, but the changing sort of political makeup of that, that despite the CP's control of the bureaucracy, which they maintained throughout, right through to 73, amongst the ranks and the leaderships, key sort of factory level leaderships, and you see this, of course, with the Cordones Industriales, we'll talk about that later, but amongst the leaderships in the factories, it was young workers who were coming to the fore and basically challenging that Stalinist leadership of the organised labour movement. So that gives you some sense of, you know, some of the key factors in terms of the relation class forces in Chile itself. The essential outcome of that was that the new left, and this is the important thing in terms of, I suppose, what we're trying to talk about here in this conversation, which is this inevitably under-matured revolutionary subject. So in 1964, or mid-60s, you had essentially a Stalinized labor movement, deeply Stalinized labor movement, a very strong labor movement, probably the strongest in the continent, but definitely the strongest in the continent, but very Stalinized through the CP principally, but also through the Christian Democrats and the unions, who were effectively Stalinist agents in the unions as well and worked hand in hand with the CP. Have similar, you know, examples in Europe, of course, of that. Not quite the Socialist Party, but basically from the mid-60s on, you start, this new left starts to develop. And it starts to develop within the Socialist Party. It starts to develop in the Mapu current, and it starts to develop in the MIR. So I'm going to give you now, I will quote a few things just to give you a bit more a real sense of what's going on during this time. Yeah, so we've skipped ahead into the post-70s period, but we can keep, if they can keep rotating, people can see some of the stuff, hopefully, that we're talking about. So the MIR officially formed in a congress in Santiago in August 1965 in the Anarchist Hall of Santiago. There's still remembrances of that hall there. And it included some anarchists. But it basically was made up of two main organisations, but within those organisations, a whole range of tendencies, basically, as small as the organisations were at the time. So the first organisation was the Vanguardia Revolucionaria Marxista Rebelde, so the Revolutionary Vanguard dash, you know, back then people liked their dashes on organisations when they're out of fashion, but anyway, Rebel Marxists. And that was basically an organisation, in fact it was entirely an organisation based in Concepcion, which historically had always been one of the most militant cities in Chile, for the obvious reason that it's a port town. This is where Miguel Enriquez and the key, what became later the key leadership of the MIR came out of, and they were all students. Miguel Enriquez was a medical student. But they weren't all like him, he came out of him and a group of people around him in this organisation came out of the Socialist Party, and they were forced. It's not their hand was forced. So this is an interesting thing in terms of thinking about what you do tactically in an organisation, in a context, because, you know, one can step back and think, okay, maybe what should have happened is that the revolutionary left should have just gone into the Socialist Party. But it wasn't always a choice. So they were literally pretty much expelled or chucked out of the Socialist Party. Mm-hmm. Another key leader, Luciano Cruz, who was one of the key central leaders of the MIR, he came out of the Communist Party, likewise completely marginalised, and it wasn't a choice. And they formed the backbone of this Vanguardia Revolucionaria in Concepción. But then there was another big and important sort of, it was a single organisation, but sort of grouping all sorts of essentially revolutionary syndicalists and various militants from the Socialist Party. It was called the Movimiento de Fuerzas Revolucionarias, MFR, which had actually formed itself much earlier in 61, and it was led most notably by one of the most important historic figures in the Labor movement in Chile, Gordario Best, who, I don't know if you know Gladio, but I can't remember, he didn't die too long ago. Like, he lived very, he lived to 100, but anyway, survived, yeah, he survived the coup, I think, in exile. But anyway, he was, there is probably no one more associated with the organised workers movement, the Labor movement itself, trade unions on the left, than Gordario Best. He sort of wrote every book about, you know, the radical workers and the union movement, et cetera. He was a key leader of this group. But there was also people from this other little party called Partido Socialista Popular. There were elements of the Partido Radical, Chilean Partido Radical, which even in the election 1970, well, in election 1970, most of it came over to the Unidad Popular. But in previous elections, the Partido Radical was actually quite an important force. So they were the equivalent of the Australian Labor Party. They were sort of a Labor tradition party. So to the right of the Socialist Party, but in not sort of social democrats, a bit more sort of national, populist nationalist. But, you know, earlier than in the early 60s and earlier in, well, post-war, they were getting high votes. This is a party with 20, 30, you know, percent vote, potentially forming government with other forces. Anyway, a number of elements out of the PR, which by the 60s were radicalising quite substantially, came out of that in the early 60s, young activists and were part of this MFR group. There was an anarchist group called Libertario, a couple of other, I won't go through, there's a couple of other sort of small parties. So that was the MIR. At the same time, so that was in 65. Within 2 years, though, the political perspective of the MIR had been very clearly determined, or won, the leadership of it had been won over by the Miguel Enriquez current. And they'd marginalised, well, they marginalised the Trotskyist group that was part of it. And the Trotskyist group was probably the smallest group in it, but it did have an important intellectual figure who ended up being expelled from the MIR, actually, Luis Vidal. That group was, at the founding conference of the MIR, was the Bor, which, again, a name common in Latin America, you know, Workers' Revolutionary Party, like the Bor in Bolivia. Vidal himself, I think, yeah, he was expelled at some point. But in any case, they were marginalised pretty quickly, and so was Daniel Bess and the syndicalists. They were marginalised pretty quickly. And basically, Miguel Enriquez, joined by people like Luciano Cruz, coming out of the CP, formed what became the hegemonic leadership of the MIR, which was essentially a sort of a Guevarist leadership, basically. You know, certainly Marxist-Leninist in word. I mean, you know, every declaration was where Marxist-Leninist and Lenin quotes galore. And they were certainly in that direction of politics. No doubt that they were revolutionaries in the broad sense of the word. But the tactical mistakes that became quite critical sort of originate in that grouping taking the leadership in 67 rather than any other grouping, which is not just a comment on them. It's also a comment on the weakness of all the other forces that were not able to combat that, including the Trotskyist forces, which in Chile had always been very intellectualist. I mean, Vidali, for example, great intellectual. He wrote a brilliant three-volume Marxist history of Chile, which I think Verso's published, but not in English. But he was an intellectual. Like, he never really went beyond being intellectual. So, he was good on a conference floor, but he wasn't the one on the ground. Gordario Best was in that tendency. They were on the ground, you know, sort of fighting this struggle within the MIR. They lost. They lost partly because, in many respects, that sort of the growing revolutionary awareness, including the, you know, what you could say might call the Leninist understanding of strategy and tactics, was never going to play out in Chile exclusively in one organisation. And the reality is that there was as much going, like if you were, to put it sort of crudely, if you were a revolutionary, you literally wouldn't know who to pick because there was as much going from a revolutionary point of view inside the Socialist Party. And in fact, you can make a case that was the place to be. In fact, you can make a case that at a certain point, the key thing the MIR should have done is dissolved into the Socialist Party because it's in the Socialist Party that the bulk of the actual vanguard of the working class, like the workers that were leading on the ground, that's where they were. So in the factories, if you went around the factories and you asked the workers that were, you know, that were getting up and making their case, the radical case for revolution on the factory floor, they were almost not exclusively, but largely Socialist Party militants, with very few, the only exceptions being some of the MIR, because the MIR did, between 1970 and 73, did start to win a lot of workers. But, you know, it sort of came too late. And that to some extent, change their discourse. And you see it in that that final speech of the Yellow Lickers. It's a very good speech. You know, it says all the right things about what has to be done then, but it was too late, really, by then, because that was a speech made 3 months before. It was on, I'm pretty sure it was either, I can't remember now, it was on the eve or just after the first coup, which was, you know, June. So, you know, it was already too late because, you know, every worker knew what was coming. And, you know, they held off that first coup, but that was just a dress rehearsal. So the MiG was moving in the right direction, but it all started to happen too late. And arguably, really, the key debates were probably happening years earlier in the Socialist Party. So just to give you an idea of what was going on in the Socialist Party. Oh, sorry, I meant to say to you, just first up to give you an idea of, you know, the MiG sort of compass right from the beginning. So the only document that was adopted at that August 1965 founding conference, Congress of the MiG, was a document titled La Conquista del Poder por la Vía Insurreccional. So the conquering of power via insurrectional road, which there's nothing technically wrong with that. It was a Leninist perspective, but it had to be filled out tactically. That was the problem. You know, what do you do to walk that road of insurrection? You know, if they increasingly under the leadership of Miguel Enriquez, what that meant, how they interpret that tactically, what was correct strategically, how they interpret that tactically was armed actions and the armed organisation of workers, which in and of itself wasn't wrong. It just had to be a secondary tactic, you know, in the context of, or really mostly in the context of fighting the reformist, Stalinist leadership of the labour movement in general, to some extent the organised campesinos and the movement in general. Because throughout this whole period, right, including all this 60s period I'm describing, throughout this whole period, the CP's main profession was slamming the provocateurs. And the provocateurs included, they were constantly, I wish I put up some of their covers from El Siglo. El Siglo was a daily, actually, and El Siglo would regularly run covers basically egging on the Frei government to prosecute. In fact, one cover I think was early on here you would have seen. The Frei government did jail the General Secretary of the Socialist Party about 66 period, and started jailing a lot of Socialist Party militants. And by the time the MiG was going, they were the main target of the Communist Party, but not exclusively. So, you know, the Communist Party were constantly running this propaganda against provocateurs. And it's sort of fascinating that, you know, 50 years later, or however long, the official line of the CP is still that the coup happened because of the provocations of the MIR. Well, that's the official historical line. Like, I mean, people don't like to talk about it, but, like, that's the official line of the CP. The Socialist Party this time, so that's what I was going to get to, they had a Congress in 1967, it was in Chiang, just about to find it, where they took a very, quite a radical sort of position vis-a-vis that sort of growing revolutionary struggle, revolutionary struggle in Chile. This is just some of the statements from the Socialist Party. For example, from their second secretary, the sub-secretary under Altavidano, his name was... Adonis. Adonis. He says, "Se di una perspectiva." Sorry, I didn't translate. So it would be an perspective for workers' aspirations to follow an electoral road. Like, so very early on, you know, they were making a case against the parliamentary road to socialism. Despite the fact that, you know, would become Allende would be the candidate for a Socialist Party candidate, was chosen as the candidate to represent the Unidad Popular. That wasn't uncontested, remember, because the other people that put their hat in the ring included Pablo Neruda, CP, a range of other sort of from Partido Radical, etc. But, I mean, it became pretty obvious, including to the left, to be fair, that Allende was the obvious candidate if he wanted to win. because he had such a long parliamentary history. And he went back to being, God, he was health minister in one of the 30 sort of popular front governments. You know, like he had a long history. So he knew how to sort of play the game. So in a certain sense, tactically, it wasn't the wrong thing for even the left to support him to be the candidate. But what occurred, of course, is that under the leadership of Allende and the moral weight and so forth that he had, he aligned the government to the CP. So Allende basically from day one was the mouthpiece of the CP, not of the Socialist Party. And in fact, he was constantly in collision with the leadership of the actual Socialist Party, never mind the rank and file of the Socialist Party. So there was all sorts of... Oh, hey, here, I found the... So this was the Congress, the Socialist Party's Congress in 1967 in Zhejiang, just south of Santiago. The Socialist Party, as a Marxist-Leninist organisation, puts forward the perspective that we must take power as our strategic perspective. Basically making the case again that the parliamentary road, you know, was not the actual strategic sort of endpoint for the Socialist Party, but rather the actual taking of power, including through the use, and they mentioned directed use of violence, insurrection, et cetera, et cetera. So that was the perspective of the leadership and membership of most of the Socialist Party. So you can see in the 60s, there's just a constant radicalisation. Like, it's just constant radicalisation that starts despite all the attempts by the Communist Party to muffle it and squash it, it starts to radicalise not only whole sections of society. Obviously, I think we've discussed the growing unionisation of campesinos, rural workers, you know, the young workers taking more of a lead at the factories, rural level, etc. But it starts to radicalise political organisations, even of the right. So, and this, of course, is contradictory because it also gives some, it breathes another bit of life into the Reformist Stalinist project, right? Because, you know, you have revolutionaries growing strength, making their case, the CP having to back off and back off. But, of course, as they're backing off, at the same time, because the radicalisation is so profound, the very centrist and right-wing parties that the CP had sought, its entire history, to form popular fronts with, i.e. in particular the Partido Radical and the Christian Democrats, they themselves radicalised. And amongst their youth, that radicalisation is quite deep. So they split, whole sections split and form, the Izquierda Cristiana becomes an actual real revolutionary organisation, and that came out of the youth of the Christian Democrats. So the PR, the Partido Radical, that just blows up basically as a historic force because the bulk of its young ranks go into the Socialist Party, into the MIR. They just, massive radicalisation. So it's a contradictory, you know, context because the radicalisation itself also, as I said, breathes some life into the reformists through giving them the option to continue to sort of argue for and pursue this popular front in the Stalin sense of the word. You know, look, the Christian Democrats are radicalising. We can join with the Christian Democrats. I mean, putting it a bit crudely, but that's the essence basically. Right until the election in September 1970, basically the CP would have preferred a popular front government with the Christian Democrats. But that was really their preference. The problem is they couldn't impose that preference because of the weight of the Socialist Party. That's where Allende's candidature was not unimportant tactically, because actually that made it ironic because obviously, as I said, he became a mouthpiece for the CP, but it also made it impossible for the CP in the first instance to impose that more right-wing interpretation of a popular front. Because, look, I mean, the Unidad Popular government was definitely a popular front in the classic Stalin sense, but it wasn't the most right-wing manifestation of that. The most right-wing would have been with the Christian Democrats. But the crisis of that 64-69 Frei government made that impossible because there was not a party anymore that offered anything, really. So it made it impossible to impose that perspective of the CP. So you get to, look, I've probably spoken too long. It's probably better if people have got questions or comments I want to make. So obviously you get to that period in the late 60s where a left government of some sort, you know, popular front, but left in terms of platform and the reforms that were pushed was sort of becoming inevitable. You know, the real question was the content of that, how radical. Now, that is becomes a debate that goes on right through to 73. And it's this is why people sometimes, you know, intellectuals on the left will often refer to the Allende government as the only example of a Marxist-elected government. And the reason for that, that's not technically true. They weren't a Marxist government. Well, you can't elect a Marxist government. But anyway, putting that aside, that what it does express a certain truth, i.e., it was a very fucking left-wing, you know, social democratic government, right? Unparalleled, probably to even unparalleled till then, certainly unparalleled since then. Like that's, you know, almost, you know, a joke to suggest otherwise. But and if you read the platform of the Popular Unity, it's not just that they had a whole range of demands that were, you know, decent left social democratic demands, but it's that actually the platform also argued the Socialist Party's strategic perspective for power. So basically, they tried to encase the reformism of the CP's Popular Front. It's like they tried, and well, they were successful, forcing that Popular Frontism into the Socialist Party's broader strategic perspective. And the reason, this goes back to my initial sort of thesis for this talk, the reason they were able to do that is because that the militants, the revolutionaries inside the Socialist Party, inside the MID, et cetera, Mapu, because we're talking tens of thousands of revolutionaries, quite fucking clear-minded revolutionaries, and some great leaderships and leaders amongst them, couldn't find tactically the way to beat that reformist agenda, you know, to suppress it, you know, to expose them. They just couldn't find it. And a lot of that was based, takes me back to my first point, partly, this is where it gets interesting, like how much was inevitable? Because some of this was sort of historically determined because the CP had for so long dominated the labour movement. You don't easily change that, you know, when you've got, you know, every union bureaucrat is a CPR. And it's a very monolithic organisation. It's not like the sort of left groups we're used to now, you know, that split willy-nilly all the time. It's not easy to split the that sort of monolithic old Stalinist CP. So part of it was sort of historically determined. But I think one can make a very good case, and certainly even amongst the MR Social Party people would make the case that it wasn't inevitable, like that certain things could have happened, certain decisions could have been made that would have changed the course of history in Chile. And they, the responsibility, and both negative and positive, I don't mean that entirely in a negative sense, positive and negative, laid pretty squarely on the MID and the left of the, well, Socialist Party really, but, you know, Altamirano or some of the key leaders. Because it's not like there wasn't attempts. I mean, even, you know, one of the most tragic stories of the coup itself is the meeting that happened the morning of the coup in this brilliant accounts of this meeting too and who survived because they were gunned down and so forth. A meeting that was called by the MIR of the leaders of all the left parties, you know, and it happened in a warehouse in Santiago. So Miguel Enriquez was there, all the Socialist Party key leaders were there. The CP didn't send any of their key leaders. They sent an observer because the CP's line, even on the day of the coup, was we'll wait, no resistance now on the streets, we'll wait until the parliament declares. I mean, there was no fucking parliament. They got rid of the parliament first moment of the coup. So the CP only sent a representative. But the left, that meeting was a culmination of what had been an ongoing sort of attempts at a revolutionary unity of principally the Socialist Party, the MID and Mapu, who together numbered in the tens, well, hundreds of thousands of probably militants. And amongst those hundreds of thousands, definitely, you know, a core of 20,000, you know, Bolshevik cadre, basically, you know, the equivalent thereof, within the MID, within the PS, and within Mapu. And the Christian left, too, was part of it, et cetera. So it's not like there weren't attempts at some of the tactical decisions that perhaps needed to be made, but they sort of all came too slow, too late, really. You know, and of course, you know, it's cliche, but the rest is sort of tragic history, really. I mean, even in the context of the coup itself, it's not impossible. That meeting wasn't just sort of like, you know, sort of hopeless, you know, final goodbye. It actually did represent in part the fact that even in the context of the coup itself, a revolutionary road had not yet been entirely ruled out. And in a sort of tragic way, you see that or you hear that in Allende's speech itself that morning, because for those of you who've ever read, it's worth reading his, it's translated in English, I think, in a few places. So he made two speeches from radio on the day of the coup. And forget the order now. But anyway, one of the speeches, the one I think was about 7 a.m., and then there was one at 9 a.m. before Radio Cooperativa was bombed, because they bombed the radio that it was transmitting from or through the antennas. It's in the first one, I think. In the first speech at 7 a.m., he says, workers, stay at your factories, prepare to defend, you know, the process, the revolutionary process. And then in the 9 a.m. speech, he says, the more famous speech is where he says, you know, I don't want to see Chilean blood spilt, et cetera, et cetera. So it's actually worth reading the two speeches, because even in his own words, it expresses this fact that even at the last hour, a revolutionary solution had not been entirely ruled out, historically speaking. If Allende himself, I mean, if it wasn't going to happen, but it probably expresses the depth of possibility. The fact that if he had only made that 7 a.m. speech, there would not have been a successful coup. It's not guaranteed, it wouldn't have guaranteed a revolution, but there would not have been a successful coup, because there was tens of thousands, there was tens of thousands of workers who in factories that heard that first call and stayed in those factories. In all the cordones industriales were armed with what little, you know, guns were available, etc. So and they didn't need guns anyway, because I mean, this is all forgotten, but even when was it, in the only days before, I forget how many days now, right? I don't know if you might remember, but only days before the coup, 1 million people, the biggest march in Chilean history, had marched to Santiago. Now, back then, 1 million people in Santiago, you're talking about half the population of Santiago. So, and that's not to mention other cities. So in that context, you know, even that if Allende's call had been limited to that first call, a successful coup would not have happened. I mean, maybe another solution would have occurred rather than a revolution, right? But it would have at least left the road open for revolutionaries to reorganise, you know, and to find those tactics that they hadn't found. So, in that sense, it wasn't, you know, inevitable. So I'll finish on that saying that, as I said, I think there is an inevitability in all revolutionary processes, that the revolutionary subject will arrive at that moment immature. Like, I think it's just inevitable. Like, we won't be ready-made. The real question is whether there's enough there, you know, to do what Lenin and key, because it wasn't all the Bolshevik Central Committee, but key parts of the Bolshevik Committee were able to do between February, or signal between February and October. So I think that's probably the interesting, it's very broad and abstract in a way, but it's an interesting lesson for us that is, apart from the obvious propagandistic point that, you know, you don't make revolutions through parliamentary elections. I'll leave it there.